The time for talking is over.
The match clock showing 4 hours and 12 minutes.
Thibodeau lobs him. And gets
it. Going to have a short for him inside in. Murray, they are running.
Got it! He's got it! What's the smash like? It's good! It's good from Porter!
Sits it back. An ace out wide!
And Arena Sabalenka collapses on Rod Laver Arena.
And it is 10 of the absolute best for Novak Djokovic.
Hi everyone and welcome to the AO Show with me, John Hoovenaars. Indian Wells has thrown up some absolute beauty so far, and now we're down to the business end. Here's what's coming up on the show. Fire and ice, why Holger Rune could be the perfect fold for Carlos Alcaraz.
Maybe he's the McEnroe of this era. He's that one that brings the edginess.
The need for speed, Emma Raducanu on her penchant for fast cars and blockbusters.
I love the big courts, the big matches, the big occasions.
And we check in with Australian Open Tournament Director, Craig Tiley.
Our goal is to get every single player in Australia for the whole month of January.
That's all ahead on the AO Show. All eyes are on the Californian desert this week. Here are the headlines. Daniil Medvedev's win streak continues despite his issues with the courts of Indian Wells. Iga Swiatek back to her brutal best, yet to drop a set on her way to the quarterfinals. Holger Rune and Stan Wawrinka renew hostilities as the triple major champ gets squarely back inside the top 100. Elena Rybakina and Arina Sabalenka on track for a rematch of their Australian Open final. Carlos Alcaraz becomes the second fastest man in history to reach win number 100. And Rafael Nadal's time in the top 10 about to come to an end after a record 18 years. Joining me on the round table today are Todd Woodbridge and Peter Mercado. And Pete, I think this is the first time we've had you on since the AO men's final.
I know, it's been a little bit of a break, John, but it's nice to be back and nice to be talking about tennis in the desert rather than at Melbourne Park.
Absolutely, plenty happening in the Californian desert. Todd, you're just back from, would you call it a working holiday? How was that?
Most definitely a working holiday in the Maldives. Look, I had to give a couple of lessons a day, which was a lot of fun because I don't get out on the court that much at helping people. And I had a wide range from a couple of young kids that were 5 and 6 beginning the game to some people who were absolute fans and fitness freaks. So it got me in a bit of shape. It actually got me out sweating and enjoying a bit of time on court. And then I was so exhausted I had to cool off in the magnificent waters and do a bit of snorkeling.
Nice work if you can get it.
True.
Now, the overall quality of tennis at Indian Wells this week has been pretty impressive. And at the time of recording this podcast today, Daniil Medvedev has just completed his 18th consecutive match win, bookended by wins over Alejandro Davidovic Fokina.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Medvedev's in a really good... He's such a fascinating player to watch, but we already knew that. And I love the banter that he's had all the way through this tournament because he's just found plenty of things to complain about. This is a guy that's winning. Yes, he's had some tough matches that he's had to get through, but he's complained about the court surface. It's too slow. It's not a hard court. And basically, everything is kind of radiated out from there. He even admits himself that it really is a distraction for him, but he just can't help himself. He's got to keep talking about it. But it's working, and he's just, again, normal services resume with Daniel, and he just continues to roll along.
I really like what he's doing. It's fun to see him engaged in the battle, and what I mean by that is that when he's doing exactly what you're talking about, Pete, he's actually in the match with it. Sometimes he can lose the plot and it goes outside the court and it's into the stands and it's everywhere else. And that's when he's not playing his best. But on this run that he's on at the moment, it's fun to watch him play. I just like the variety that not only his personality brings, but that his game brings to the court. You know, it's unique to watch. And, you know, it's good to have him back playing so well.
And he's going to be adding to that too. Interesting, you know, he's been talking about consciously coming into the net. We know he stands basically back out in the car park to receive serve and he's way back in the court. But now he's sort of getting the idea that he's got to come forward a little bit more and his volleying is improving too. So he's just going to keep adding weapons to what's already a really amazing game.
And you've got to love that too. You've got to enjoy when a player recognises that they've got to keep adding to their game and that they're willing and able is really important to do that, because that's that step up to be able to win another major for him and go deep. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to watching him on the grass at Wimbledon to see if he can come out of the car park and stand up a little bit more onto the baseline, because I think that's going to be necessary there to win.
Well, it is if you're on one of the outside courts, you do have to step in because the baseline to wall ratio is very short.
Indeed.
But if you're on number one court, you're in all sorts of trouble because he'll be miles back in the court. But it's really been an interesting tournament because obviously we haven't had Djokovic there. We've got Medvedev as kind of the mainstay, but then we've got Carlos Alcaraz, who's here as the top seed, who's just picked up where he's left off after the injury problems that he's had. And he's been rolling his way through. And we talk about someone who's got, you know, that all-court sort of game. The thing that's been great to see from him is the way that he's been serving. I mean, we talk about the fact that he can chase balls down, he's so strong from the back of the court, and he's got the big web. That serve, that's one of the big reasons why he's steamrolling his way through this draw right now.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because although he's been injured and didn't play the Australian Open, and this is really, we're seeing him back for the first time for a period, it would seem to me that the injury is about improving his game. And I mean, don't want injuries, but it's allowing him a block of training to continue to work on things, which is so smart in a way, because he's come back with a bigger serve. What's he going to do each time he takes a break? Because his body is still developing and he has to be very aware that he has to look after that to get a long career. So this little injury break, not playing the Australian Open, seems to have done him the world of good, because he's come back with a weapon that was solid but now become something even better.
And what I also want to see too is that with particularly Alcaraz, and you know, he's had his injury problems, we know that the Djokovic story and everything that's happened over the last couple of years with him, we want to see these guys, these two in particular, I'm fascinated to see them play multiple times. So we need to see them playing more and more. And I suspect, Todd, that will come to the fore. You may be calling at Court Philippe Chatrier coming up in the middle of the year, one of those encounters. And I'm going to be fascinated to see, after this period of time, where those two are at and doing battle on clay in particular.
So Alcaraz reaches his 100th match win in just 132 professional matches. And Todd is the second fastest player ever to do so after John McEnroe.
Yeah, quite extraordinary to be able to bring a record like that so young. And I look at that hoping that he's able to sustain that. I mean, that's just incredible, because it's a lot of pressure on a young player. We haven't seen a young player rise like this for so long. So you talk about McEnroe, Chen came through those quick ranks, so has Nadal more recently in the last decade or so. So this is a new era of potential dominance, and those numbers are extraordinary, but those numbers need to be monitored in a sense of not overplaying, not burning himself out, giving himself what we now know through technology, fitness, opportunity to play well into his 30s if he chooses to. Very hard to do, I think, unless you've got somebody pushing you like Rafa, Roger and Novak have been able to do to each other to keep setting new goals. So extraordinary numbers, and we'll see where he can take them. But obviously with those numbers, multiple Grand Slam titles look likely for Carlos, but let's see how the team around him can manage him throughout these next 3 to 5 years potentially.
And I think, too, part of that, if we look through the results, I mean, US Open aside, but, you know, he's winning his matches, he's getting through reasonably quickly, whereas for some other players, when they make that breakthrough, they have wobbles, they might be pushed deep to three sets or five sets, and obviously he's had a little bit of that. Not playing in January, you mentioned earlier, Todd, the fact that he's been able to work on his game, he'd be a little more relaxed coming into the season, can maybe be, you know, play the clay court season smart as well before getting onto the grass and making decisions there. But, you know, the fact that he's getting through his matches, a lot of these matches, reasonably comfortably and reasonably quickly too, I think that's going to help him sort of as he builds his career. But I think you're right. We're looking for that rivalry to come in, because we've got to have that expectation that we've had a big three, we've had a big four, we need to replace all of them. Looks like he's going to be the figurehead for the time to come, and it's a matter of seeing where the challenges are going to come from.
Well, talk about challenges, because one of the players that, you know, I'm watching and I really like watching and I'm having mixed emotions about is Holger Rune and how he's playing some awesome tennis, but he keeps getting caught up in unnecessary attitude issues on court. And it's pretty obvious the locker room, he doesn't have their love. And I've got to say how brilliant it was to see Stan Wawrinka back playing so well. I mean, he seems to be edging his way closer to that form that we saw when he won his majors. And he just brings another element to the game that's so good to watch with the single-handed backhand. And as we progress through having a look at the draw as of today, you know, Jannik Sinner goes out and beats Wawrinka 1-4. So he's that other contender to Alcaraz, Rune, but has the temperament, I think, that is the steady one that might be able to go deeper. But, you know, I mean, Rune, maybe he's the McEnroe of this era. He's that one that brings the edginess, which brings the contrast, which is going to make it exciting.
And that contrast too with Alcaraz the other day, he was playing another young player, Jack Draper, and Draper retired in that match and he wrote on the camera, you know, get well soon, Jack, and everyone's going, oh, isn't that nice, isn't that lovely? But you also need to have that contrast too. I think, you know, we see that a little bit with Medvedev sort of playing that role as the villain, and maybe Rune is now the heir apparent to that side of things too. And as long as he can back it up with his tennis, then, you know, I think he'll start to get a fan base along the way, maybe probably outside the locker room rather than inside it.
It's probably where you need that fan base, actually. If you love too much in the rock locker room, it means you're not focused.
Indeed. Well, we love a ruthless villain every now and then in tennis. It helps the storylines tick along very nicely for us watching on at home. Speaking of which, Iga Swiatek is in some ruthless form at the moment, and as we record this, is still yet to drop a set on the way to the quarterfinals and looks every chance a champion of Indian Wells this year.
Well, she does. I mean, given what she's been able to do over the last 12 months or so, where she's been the dominant player. But I think she's going to be challenged by Sabalenka. Sabalenka, for me, is really impressive in how she's got over the issues with her serve. And I guess winning the Australian Open showed that she was able to get rid of those demons. She played incredibly well there. And I think watch out, because she's such a force with her power game that when she's confident, she's going to beat up on a lot of the other players. So for Swiatek to beat her, she's going to have to absorb all of that. And it's a different, I think, matchup coming if those two were to get to play each other, not just potentially here, but as we move throughout the season.
It seemed to be a theme. I remember we were doing a roundtable around this time last year, or around Roland Garros time last year, where we were talking about Swiatek, and she was steamrolling her way through draws there as well. And she's just got this ability to be able to get through comfortably. And we've seen that with top players in the world over the years. I remember the days of Steffi Graf and Monica Seles, and they would just, you know, don't worry about the first week of a major, because they'd get through minimum of fast, barely be pushed, and then they'd reset themselves for the next week. But I agree. I mean, the fact that, you know, Sabalenka is playing so well and has that belief, and so much belief coming off the back of the Australian Open, that she can be right up there as right at the top of the sport. But we've also got other players like Kvitova, who's playing Sakkari they're playing after we record this. So, I mean, everything just points to an interest with the WTA, and it's just the names that are just changing at the moment. So, yes, we've got Swiatek, but now we've got Sabalenka, who's right there, kind of a rivalry building. But, you know, Rybakina is also still in this draw, and we don't talk about her at all, yet we should be. She's here as the 10th seed.
Could see a rematch of the women's final.
Well, potentially, yeah, because, you know, she's been working her way through the draw with a minimum of fuss too, and beating some good players, beat Badosa along the way here at Indian Wells, yet that could be the challenge for Swiatek, but we rarely talk about her. But she's one of those players that, well, she's seeded 10 here, but, you know, deserves to be a lot higher.
I agree with you on Rybakina. I mean, I got lucky and made a call really early at Wimbledon that I thought she was going to win the tournament. She goes along and does it. But I think she technically is one of the best players that are on tour right now. The grips are good. There's no breakdown in any of her shots. And then once she gets her serve going, it's like as good as any in the women's game. So she is that force that I think has the temperament not to get intimidated and as nervous as some of the other players. But the flip side to that type of temperament is that sometimes she's a little passive with her emotions when in a match, if she could just sort of unleash a little bit of extra intensity, it might get her over the line. But yes, I mean, she's not going anywhere. If you add her Wimbledon points, you know, she would be much higher than she is, Pete.
What about the rise of the young British brigade coming through? You mentioned Jack Draper earlier. He took down, well, first of all, took down Dan Evans and then Andy Murray in straight sets. Add to that Emma Raducanu, who was also on a strong run before she encountered Świątek. What's the state of British tennis, do you think, Todd?
Well, it's a different mindset now than what I remember, particularly in, you know, my era of playing. The Brits were, lacking in confidence, that they didn't have any belief that they could do well anywhere other than perhaps get a wild card at Wimbledon and maybe win a round. That was a good result. Now, I think because of what Andy Murray's been able to do and his manner and his approach to things has really changed the way that the players compete, the way that they've developed. I mean, I'm a big fan of watching Dan Evans play because he's a throwback to the style that I like to play myself, but he brings a little bit of edginess to it. And then you put in, you know, Emma winning a US Open, and all of a sudden you have this sort of ability to ride on the coattails of the success of like Andy and these other players now, and they all start to believe and they drag each other along, and that's just fantastic. That's exactly what you hope for. And the key is to keep getting numbers in their development programs so that they can match all of the things that are happening now. But probably was a real changing of the guard and a moment in time for Andy to reflect upon where he is now with, you know, it's not a comeback anymore. He's been out on tour for some time. It's been extraordinary to do what he's done with his hip. But it was a passing of the baton somewhat this week is how I read those results as well.
Absolutely. And Cam Norrie, we throw him in there too, into that mix. And if Todd's going to claim Rebecca to winning Wimbledon, I.e. Mark Draper for finishing inside the top 50 about a quarter of the way through last year, because he's got that big game, huge game, and he's now starting to understand the weaponry that he's got and starting to string those results together. And part of that challenge for these young players coming through, I mean, Alcaraz aside, is getting used to playing at the level. So he gets exposure at 250s, then through to 500s, and then that ranking continues to rise, make a little bit of an impact at the majors, which I think is just a separate dynamic all on its own that needs to be mastered. But now is playing regularly at the Masters 1000 level and matching it with the best in the world. And he's learning a lot about himself now. So he, for me, on the men's side, is that one for British tennis that's going to be that figurehead for the next little while anyway.
And talking about playing to that level, Pete, what he has to do and what is so, so important in this modern game is the physical side of things. And that's the part that's let him down. You remember the Australian Open against Rafa, he played great, but he just couldn't sustain the level of intensity and movement required for five sets to beat that type of champion player. So he's looking at that going, right, I actually need to get that part of my game to another level, which, you know, if we go back to the beginning of this discussion, we talked about that with Alcaraz, that those breaks from him have worked. They work so hard in those breaks now to come back to be able to improve in the physical aspect that the men's game in particular requires now.
Well, if you look at the current rankings, it's Andy Murray, 55, Jack Draper, 56, but I dare say we'll see a reversal in that as Draper climbs higher. Cam Norrie knocking on the door of the top 10, and Rafael Nadal will finally, after 18 years almost, drop out of the top 10 for the first time since he entered it all those years ago.
And I think too, it's passing of eras and times and everything like that. But hey, we're starting to get some sort of read on the players who are slowly getting on in age, relatively speaking, of course, and getting towards the end of their careers and really trying to manage that as best as possible. I mean, you know, trying to get Rafa back out on the court. He's going to have another go at the clay, going to have another go at winning Roland Garros again, and just getting some sort of idea and read on the fact that, okay, not going to be number one in the world necessarily anymore, but he just wants to play for those big moments towards the end, which we saw a little bit with Roger Federer too. So fingers crossed he can have a decent clay court season, have a really good run at it again.
Extraordinary to think that someone can stay in that ranking bracket for that amount of time. And I just wonder whether Rafa thinks about it. I mean, we all do, and I wonder whether somebody like him, who doesn't seem to have ever thought about defending and those types of issues or time, is looking at it now going, how much more can I give? Because it's been an extraordinary length that he's been able to maintain. He's maintained that too with some injury issues and blocks away from the game. So I don't know. Maybe this clay court season might be the last time we really see him at tournaments, I feel. I'm not sure he's going to last the year out.
Well, we'll keep a close eye on him. The total time was 912 weeks. It started in April 2005, age 18, and it has been half a lifetime spent in the best 10 players in the world. Quite extraordinary.
John, that means that I retired half a lifetime ago.
Half Rafa's lifetime.
That was, I retired 3 months. 3 months later was when I retired at Wimbledon. So there you have it.
There you go. So he's been, so we could have said Rafael Nadal has been in the top 10 for all of Todd Woodbridge's professional retirement.
It's amazing.
Which has been just as good, by the way, just as good the retirement into the media and everything else too. So let's mention that. That's top 10.
Indeed. It's been a top 10 life lived by Todd Woodbridge. Hey, boys, thanks for joining us on the roundtable today. We'll catch up with you very soon.
Thanks, John.
Have a good one, guys.
For the best part of the past two decades now, British tennis has been almost single-handedly carried by one man, Andy Murray. But over the past few years, we've witnessed the rise of a new generation of stars: Cameron Norrie, Emma Raducanu, and Jack Draper. There was symbolism in Draper's defeat of Murray at Indian Wells this past week, something of a handing over of the baton from one of the greats of the game to one of its brightest young talents. But who is Jack Draper? Ersin Kidaris had the chance to meet him and also Emma Raducanu at the Australian Open.
Yeah, I mean, a lot. I grew a lot in confidence last year, beating some really good players. Start of this year as well, I've played some good matches already, so I feel confident in my ability and the way I'm playing my tennis. And, you know, I've got to take that forward and have some belief like in myself.
How do you find rhythm in a match, and how important is it to find rhythm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important that you settle down quickly in the match. You know your game plan. For me, I like to play aggressive tennis. I like to compete as hard as I can in every point. Look to get forward and just impose my tennis on whoever I'm playing.
What do you tell yourself when you're sitting down on the bench? Say you just want a break.
Mm.
What's the self-talk then?
I suppose just in any match, you know, all these guys, they play such incredible tennis and they're there on every single point. So you've got to be mentally prepared to work hard every point. So I think it doesn't really matter what score it is in the match. You've got to be present. You've got to be willing to work hard. And that's how I explain it.
What if you just lost a break? What would the self-talk be then?
Yeah, I mean, usually if you get broken, you're a bit not in the moment. You're a bit angry, but at the same time, you got to know that there could be a chance to come back again. And like I said, if you work hard for each point, then you're likely going to give yourself an opportunity.
What do you do to kind of distract yourself sometimes when you're, you know, in a tournament and you don't want to think about tennis all the time?
Well, I mean, I'd stay in contact with friends or go on drive sometimes. I'm able to have a pretty cool car in some cities and just go for a drive.
Oh, well, do you have a car here?
Yeah, I have.
And what's it like to drive?
It's pretty sweet to drive. Yeah. If I told you the color, it'd be like, oh no.
No, tell me, please.
It's a yellow 911.
Oh, so it's a tennis ball coloured.
Yeah, exactly. Car. You're just going really discreet.
Do you have a need for speed?
Yeah, for sure. And acceleration. But I mean, a lot of traffic lights here.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. What's the thrill you're getting when you're on the court? What gets you going?
On the court, I love the big courts, the big matches, the big occasions. I think those are when I really come and thrive. And I just love the feeling of the atmosphere and all the fans getting behind either one of us. Just that feeling in the stadium, I think, is something that I really play for.
Do you see yourself as an entertainer as well as an athlete?
I'd say I do it in my own way, but yeah, like I wouldn't say I'm just an athlete. I'd say I have a personality of my own. And I like to try bring that to the court as much as possible, like really enjoying what I do and just, you know, playing with that young energy.
It's time to catch up with the Australian Open Tournament Director and CEO of Tennis Australia, as we do every month on the AO Show. Hello, Craig.
John, good to be back.
How have you been?
It's been good. I mean, as with everyone, time flies, and we're now in the mode of international travel and dealing with the international community and setting everything up for, again, another big summer of tennis in 2024. But every single day trying to get more people to play the game, and the team's working really hard to make that happen.
Yeah, so it's been 2 months today since the Australian Open started. So only 10 months to go, really, until the next one. At this stage of the year, what happens? Like, what are the building blocks that you need to get in place around March?
Well, because during the Christmas period, everyone's working. And we're working around the clock in preparing for the summer and about to deliver the summer. And so we give April a couple of weeks, the team is their Christmas period, really. And so the whole business takes time off then to regroup, I should say, and rest. And then get back to be energized to deliver the summer. But by the time we go into the April period, we'll be fully planned for 2024. What the events are, what cities they're in, the leading events particularly, what the United Cup's going to look like. We're really excited about that. There's going to be some ongoing improvements with that event. And then, of course, what we're planning on doing for the Australian Open. We are in a tougher period than we've ever been before because the macroeconomic climate is going to make for more challenges.
Sure.
Everyone's talking about cost increases. There are cost increases. You can see travel to the United States is double-digit percentages up. We rely a lot of people coming to and from the U.S. So there are going to be some challenges for us, but like every year, nothing could compare to the COVID challenges we had.
Indeed.
So I think continue to be proud of the work that the team's doing. But the next 3 weeks are going to be very focused on laying down the foundations for what the summer's going to look like, and then everyone will take a two-week break. And then we come back and we start to deliver and operationalize the 2024 summer.
And I take it you'll be off soon overseas. How much of that is focused on relationships with players, networking, making sure that the Australian Open is on their agenda for next year?
It's all of the above. It's talking to the players about what can improve the Australian Open, what they like to see different, and what their schedule is going to be, and how can we support them in that? Because it's not just the Australian Open, it's 5 weeks of tennis here in Australia and bringing all the best players here. Our goal is to get every single player in Australia for the whole month of January. And we have events that do that now, and we're able to compete with the world on offering the best opportunity for that. It's also meeting with the other slams. It's also benchmarking the events. But coming up in a couple of days, I leave for Miami, where we have a meeting with all the slams, and we're doing that more often now because we continue to work on developing common ground and formalizing our relationship and our partnership, and we're developing an environment where the slams can be much more collaborative than they've been historically, and then for the slams to be able to have a position where they can lean into ensuring that the sport's in a healthy place. We play a leadership role in that. We're the four biggest events, and when it comes to broadcast and people's interest and visitation, the slams are the biggest, and they carry with it the most history, and they become the ultimate objective of the players to win. And so we need to play our role in ensuring that the sport continues to thrive and people continue to pick up a racket and buy tickets and enjoy the entertainment. So we'll do a lot of that leading in for everyone. And obviously the next event up is Roland Garros, and so they'll be right in the operational stage of what they need to be doing to deliver.
Craig, how much of a tennis fan are you? It might go without saying, but what are the things that you like about the sport of tennis?
Oh, there's many things. I mean, I always say from my sales pitch point of view, there's no sport that you can play your whole life. You can play boys and girls, men and women. You can play singles, doubles. You can stand there and do nothing. You can run around. You can get exercise, no exercise. You can play it on different surfaces. You can play it anywhere in the world. Everyone understands the language. Together with football, it's the only sport that's in every single nation in the world, football and tennis.
Is that right?
That is. And that's a fact. A federation for the sport, that's a funded federation for tennis exists in every single country in the world, and as the case with football, other sports can't claim that. And And that, yeah, so that's a great position to be in. This position of strength. It's historically got a lot of strength and opportunity. So so that's my sales pitch for the greatness of the sport of tennis.
What about
and,
as a spectacle?
And then from a personal point of view, I follow the game. You know, I like to see how players are doing. It's much easier to follow now than it used to be. You used to have to wait for the newspaper to come out. But, you know, the last 10 years, things have changed as far as platforms go, and it's definitely much better. I think you remember the newspaper days too. They weren't that long ago.
Yeah, I've read it one or two in my time.
But I think I definitely think from a personal point of view to see how the players are doing, what's happening at the events. We've got people on the ground and obviously keep communicating and sending us pictures of what's happening. And I do love to follow it week in, week out. And I'm a bit of a sports junkie. I do like anything to do with sport. That's why this is a great city to be living in because we're the sports capital, and a lot's been written about that recently. And, you know, and I think as a state, we, you know, it's important we continue to hold that position and continue to invest and continue in play our role, which is making the Australian Open the greatest event.
That's all for this week's episode of the AO Show. Join me again next week for the latest tennis news, views and interviews. Before we go, happy birthday to Sloane Stephens, Karolina Pliskova and Kristina Pliskova this week. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do so via ozopen.com/listen or email theaoshow@tennis.com.au. Make sure you subscribe to get notifications of new episodes, and if your ears are enjoying the experience, please rate and review so more fans can enjoy the AO Show.